This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The CIA has worked for decades to better understand the human mind and how best to retrieve information that they deem essential for national security. After 9/11, they adopted a broad array of new interrogation tactics that included practices like waterboarding, confining people to small spaces, and subjecting them to extreme cold. Those practices have since been called torture. Civil rights organizations have been working to hold the CIA accountable and last week achieved what many are calling a historic victory. Victims reached a settlement in a lawsuit against two psychologists who were paid by the CIA to help design the interrogation program. The lawsuit draws attention to ongoing questions about who can be held accountable for torture and how to compensate torture survivors. Joining me in the studio today to talk about this is Deborah Weissman. She's a distinguished professor of law at UNC School of Law. Deborah, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also with us is Stephen Soltz. He's a clinical psychologist, a professor, and a director of the Master's Program in Social Justice and Human Rights at Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me start with you. Again, give us an overview. What do we know about the CIA tactics and the extent to which, I guess now, that psychologists were involved in helping them develop them?
Well, after 9/11, within a few weeks, Vice President Cheney announced on national television that we were going to go to the dark side in combating al-Qaeda. We learned fairly rapidly that the dark side included the use of techniques that have traditionally been condemned as torture around the world and by the United States government, including a number of those that you mentioned, also long-term sleep deprivation, up to 7 days or more of denial of sleep, forced standing for days at a time, forced nakedness, sexual humiliation, and many other techniques. It turns out that the people who designed this for the CIA and in many cases implemented it were two psychologists, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who had just retired from the military's SEER, or Survival Evasion Resistance Escape Program, where mild forms of some of these techniques are used to inoculate our troops from breaking down if they're subjected to torture when captured by a power that would violate the Geneva Conventions, that would abuse people. And that was the basis for what the CIA ended up doing.
You started working on these issues in 2006 when you received an email on your listserv. Tell us more about that.
Well, in 2006, in June of 2006, a senior Defense Department official said that the military would now prefer using psychologists over psychiatrists in the so-called behavioral science consultation teams at Guantanamo and elsewhere, and that this was because of the respective positions of our professional associations. The American Psychiatric Association had said its members should not be involved in these interrogations, and the American Psychological Association said that our members should be involved, in fact, had a vital role to play in interrogations at Guantanamo and elsewhere. So this aroused disturbance on many people on a psychoanalyst for social responsibility list. We wrote emails to the president of the APA because the board was meeting that weekend and received back rather kind of nasty responses that said, you know, you're a fool for listening to what the press say. I'm in believing these claims and don't believe everything you hear. And it just was very weird as to why such passion and why such unwillingness to consider what all the major press were reporting, which were abuses in the CIA and at Guantanamo, and the involvement of psychologists and other health professionals in some of those abuses.
So, Deborah Weissman, we have, in a sense, two issues, whether or not psychologists should be involved in this kind of thing, particularly if it involves illegal activity. And then, of course, you have the CIA and whether or not what they were doing was illegal. So give us a sense of what U.S. law says about torture.
Sure. So there's U.S. law, but there's also international law, and much of U.S. law is drawn from international law. There's many layers of laws that prohibit torture, and there's just no justification. There's no excuse. The term is non-derogable. There can be no legal device that can excuse or justify torture. We start with norms that we call peremptory norms, and they are so basic to the sense of dignity and civility that they don't even require a treaty or a statute for the prohibition to have the effect and force of law. And since the Nuremberg trials, those norms have been held to govern the behavior of everybody, private citizen, military contractor, government. In addition to the peremptory norms, you've got a number of treaties that we've signed and ratified, and then we've got a number of federal statutes that have further domesticated the treaties that we've signed that absolutely prohibit torture. There is nobody who is permitted to torture, and that would certainly include psychologists.
It's one thing to say that there is an absolute prohibition against a thing called torture and quite another to define torture, right? And that becomes a little more of a challenge.
Well, not too much of a challenge because the definition is contained both within the Convention Against Torture and our federal statutes. And torture has been defined as the intentional infliction of, you know, pain and suffering, be it mental or physical, for the purposes, for example, of obtaining a confession or for punishment. And so we know what torture is. It's not hard to define. And I don't think that, you know, since the time of the Spanish Inquisition, we have known that waterboarding is torture. We may call it enhanced interrogation. I think that's what the Gestapo called it. But it is torture.
So tell us about what's been going on legally since these practices came to light.
So there's been a number of efforts to obtain accountability. There were a couple of lawsuits that were filed by some of the victims of so-called enhanced interrogation. El Masri was one of the cases that was dismissed on the basis of the state secrets doctrine following that. Muhammad versus Jeppesen, another case that was filed against the company that assisted by filing dummy flight plans to enable these what we call torture taxis, the planes that take people from one place to another to be tortured. So in both of those cases, the government intervened and claimed state secrets, and the cases were not allowed to proceed. Now we've got Saleem versus Mitchell, which, of course, ended in a historic settlement. In addition to U.S. cases, it's important to mention that some of these very same plaintiffs have brought their cases before the European Court of Human Rights and in courts in the UK and Australia. Same facts, some very basic principles that sound like our principles, and those cases have gone forward. So I think that although we haven't had much success until the settlement, I think there's some reason to be a little bit optimistic that we'll make some progress. There's another case pending right now, Al-Shamari versus CACI. It's a case of torture in Abu Ghraib against a military contractor. And that case has proceeded in ways that has allowed some of the courts to make some really good statements about torture and its actionability in the courts.
Stephen Soltz, clinical psychologist and professor, let me ask you, getting back to the participation of professionals in this, professional psychologists, what do you think accounts for the rift, the big difference between what psychiatrists think they should do and should not do, in no way their professional association says, should we ever participate in this kind of thing, and the APA, the American Psychological Association, says, yeah, I think it's a good idea. In fact, it's your duty. What accounts for that rift?
Well, I think that there are several issues, and we could actually talk for hours, so I'll try and simplify the key ones. One is that psychology is broader than medicine, in that there are researchers and others, and this was used as a rationale by American Psychological Association, APA, leaders to justify this. However, those who engaged in it are licensed as health providers. They're required by the Defense Department or the CIA to be licensed. They're not researchers. So that excuse kind of falls apart. But I think the broader explanation that we can come up with is that it was seen as a way of, one, expanding job opportunities for psychologists and of getting influence by playing nice with powerful forces, the CIA and the Defense Department. You get paid back for doing that, and that the people involved were not necessarily in favor of torture, probably were not, but were just kind of ignoring what was going on. We're ignoring the warning signs because they saw an opportunity to advance the profession.
There also may have been some comfort in saying, well, we're working as contractors for this government agency, and after all, if the government agency approves that, I mean, there's your approval and there's the legality. But apparently this settlement suggests that if you're a contractor involved in something that turns out to be wrong, you personally are responsible.
Yeah, well, those two CIA contractor psychologists, I mean, they made many millions of dollars. Their firm was paid $81 million to do this. They designed this. They came up with the ideas. They implemented it. In some cases, according to the Senate Intelligence Report, Mitchell physically poured the water in waterboarding. They were involved up to their ears, and whether it was authorized somewhere else simply can't absolve them of responsibility.
Let's talk about the effectiveness of torture. This has come up over and over again, and I have seen in most journals and in much testimony, particularly by those involved in the intelligence community, that it simply doesn't work. It's not anything that the military likes. They're afraid that that the U.S. military would be subjected to the same thing, A, and B, it doesn't work. People under duress will tell you whatever they want, and it may not be true.
Yes. Now, I have to say, I'm not an expert interrogator, but I've talked to many intelligence professionals, interrogators, and those who are experienced uniformly say that. They say, we don't want to know where the line of torture is because we don't want to get anywhere near it, because that's not our job. Our job is to make people so comfortable that they want to talk, because when they're captured, they're terrified. They want to talk to somebody, and our job is to get them comfortable so that they blab. But there's another point that needs to be made, which is that the talking about torture in terms of does it get a piece of information is largely the wrong question. Torture is always part of an intelligence program when it's used for intelligence purposes, not for punishment or terrorizing populations. And when you torture, you turn off other sources of information. You know, someone may turn in their cousin who's going to bomb you because they think it's wrong, but they're much less likely to do it if you torture. You lose legitimacy. The largest recruitment for Al-Qaeda and now ISIS was Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. So it is counterproductive strategically, even if it were to get pieces of information, which it often doesn't.
Deborah Weissman, you've worked with a number of torture survivors over the years. What do you hear from them, and what is it that they would want to come from all of this?
So they actually have articulated quite clearly that what they want is an apology. That's part of the reparations project, but it is one of the most frequently enunciated requests. The Constitution Project also did a survey of torture victims, and that was the most frequent request in the package of reparations, if you will, and accountability. We worked with one individual on whose behalf we filed a petition with the UN Special Rapporteur, and it was all about the need for an apology, the legal obligations for an apology, and the way in which an apology can be fashioned to meet certain elements so that it is effective. So it does sort of shift the balance of power between the victim and the perpetrator. And so it might also tend to discourage torture in the future. So that's a really important aspect that people don't consider, and it's not that difficult an objective to achieve, it would seem to me.
No, but first you have to acknowledge that what you did was wrong, and that seems to be the
Absolutely.
Hard part. You've also been involved in work looking at what's happening in North Carolina in terms of the state's role or things happening within the state in the CIA torture program. Tell us what we know about that.
So what we know is that Aero Contractors, which is headquartered in Johnson County and has its hangar in Johnson County and also Kingston, that they are the company that has flown what are called the torture taxis, these planes that have extraordinarily rendered a good number of these victims. And we know that because we've been working with investigators from the Council of Europe, the Rendition Project, which is a think tank in the UK, and the British investigative journalism folks. So they have the flight data, and we know that these planes have been involved. We know that they go to Dulles. We know that they get some sort of briefing, and they pick up these human cargo, if you will. And the process of the rendition is in and of itself cruel and inhuman treatment, if not torture. There's a protocol for how these people are transported, and they're shackled and they're chained and they can't move and they're beaten if they try to move and they're drugged. So we know that North Carolina has been involved. We know that the state's political subdivisions, just by virtue of the fact that they lease the hangars to Aero and, you know, allow them to function via permits and inspections, have a role in accountability. And we've been asking the state now for years to investigate and to take on its legal obligation to figure out how our state's been involved.
Do you think this settlement announced last week, even though we don't know the details, certainly the plaintiffs seem happy with the outcome, will it have an effect on these investigations? Do you think that can move them forward more quickly?
You know, it's hard to know. I mean, the law is so plain, and the fact that it hasn't up until now makes me wonder what will make our state take some responsibility. I am also looking very much forward to the North Carolina Commission of Inquiry on Tortures hearings that are scheduled for the end of November, beginning of December. The commission has pulled together an incredibly impressive array of veteran military leaders, religious leaders, legal experts, torture victims, as a way of moving forward on this issue to get North Carolina to step up and take responsibility for its involvement.
Stephen Soltz, what about the psychologist as a profession, the APA? What impact is this having on your profession?
Well, especially among young psychologists, it was very disheartening. You know, if they're viewing entering a profession dedicated to helping people and furthering human welfare, and then hearing that some of our colleagues were doing something very different, and our professional association until the last couple of years did little to stop it, they were very upset, and they made this very clear and expressed it strongly to the leadership of the association. When we had a vote on a policy, and I believe it was 2008, 59% of the members who voted against involvement at Guantanamo, for example. That didn't actually change the practice, but that was a strong statement that the many, many members of the profession do not feel that this is appropriate.
Has the policy changed?
Yes, the policy changed 2 years ago after an investigation the APA was forced to call that confirmed many of the suspicions of those of us critics that APA leaders have been working very closely behind the scenes with Defense Department officials to the extent that the wording of all their supposed anti-torture statements were vetted by people who had been involved in interrogation processes to make sure that it didn't hamper anything that they wanted to do. And this forced then the association to change its policy. So psychologists have now joined the other health professions in saying that our members may not be involved in national security interrogations at any direct level. That is, they can do training on how to do a non-coercive interrogation, but nothing involving interrogation of an individual, and further cannot be involved at any site like Guantanamo that is in violation of international law.
Stephen Soltz, clinical psychologist and director of the Master's Program in Social Justice and Human Rights at Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Deborah Weissman, professor of law at UNC School of Law. Deborah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, Sisters in Crime, Penn Mysteries in the Carolinas. Stay tuned.